This is the Tamaulipas Valley Historical Society at a special meeting November the 22nd, 1965 at Jim Cassidy's home. Our speaker is Mrs. Bob Bartlett, otherwise known as BD, who will give us her talk at this time as she is unable to attend a regular special meeting. Mrs. Bartlett, we're very happy to have you with us, and we would like to start by asking your full name, and you carry on from there and tell us where you were born, your parents' name, your brothers and sisters, if you have any, and right on up through your life in Alaska.
Well, my name was Vidi Gostad, and I changed the name to Vidi Gostad, or I added to it, Vidi Gostad Bartlett. Gostad was spelled G-A-U-S-T-A-D, a good old Norwegian name. My father was a Norwegian, born in Norway, came to North Dakota as a child of 10, and grew up in Hillsboro, North Dakota. At the time of the Spanish-American War, he started west and wound up in Alaska instead of in the war. He joined those people journeying to Alaska in search of gold. He and Tony Trossett met up along the way and mined together for many, many years on Hunker, which we used to refer to as the upper country, out from Dawson. And from there they came to Cleary City in 1905. This could be corrected. It may have been June of 1906. My mother came to Alaska with a family who came to Skagway in 1902 from Montana. Mr. Rogers was coming to be the head, I think he was a superintendent of the White Pass and Yukon Railway, which had just been completed. He came from the Great Northern Railroad in Montana. And they were friends of my mother's. She was then a young woman. He didn't want to bring his wife into the wilds of Alaska alone without some close friend. So he brought my mother along for companion to his wife. And she stayed in Skagway the better part of that first year. Took a trip up to Dawson where she met my father, and they were married there. And I was born a year later in Dawson City, though my parents were mining on Hunker Creek at that time. Then with the strike on Pedro and the excitement in the Fairbanks area, of course everybody picked up and departed, including the Gostads and the Trossets. Well, it was just Tony Trossett then. We mined on Two Above Cleary for 2 or 3 years with indifferent success. I guess a living was made. And in 1909, bought 10 Below Cleary, which had already distinguished itself as being the richest claim on Cleary. And were quite successful there. As a little girl on Cleary, my memories are very bright and dear to me. They're different from most children's memories, I'm sure. I can remember Halley's Comet, seeing it from Cleary Summit. My mother was terribly excited about this, as was the neighboring woman, whose name was Mrs. Willette, and she had two daughters, Valerie and Dora. So that the two women took us children to up to the top of Cleary Summit to see this comet. Then, after some, it seems to me a lifetime, we move down to 10 below Cleary, where memory is much brighter for me. Cleary then was called Cleary City, and it was a city. There was a big hotel there with a fancy dining room, and it was the Nordale Hotel. There were many fine stores there. I can remember a store that had beautiful dresses for children and ladies. It cost a lot of money, but we liked to shop then as well as we do now. I can remember the ladies never going for an afternoon from mine to mine along the gravel paths in anything but a dressed-up dress. I remember these dresses that must have swept the ground, and how in the world they kept them even passably clean, I can't imagine. Tight-waisted dresses with long flowing skirts, gloves, hats. I have snapshots of many of these women, my mother and another woman whose name was Mrs. Bullard, Mrs. Nordale. The hats were large with big plumes flowing across them, this particular era. Maybe they were behind the times for the outside styles. This was probably 1909, up until 1910. And even when the ladies with their small children went berry picking, they did not go in jeans or men's pants. I can't remember women wearing men's clothes in those years. And none of the snapshots or pictures that I have show women wearing men's clothes, which would have been much more comfortable, of course. I do have some pictures of young children, young girls, wearing boys' overalls, they were called, at a later stage, probably a teenage stage. And as far as I know, this was the first time that girls in this country wore anything but dresses, which had to be washed and starched and ironed, and the irons were those heavy things on the back of a wood stove. Well, I'm still in this period before I went to school. There was no kindergarten. And I want to tell you about some of the characters on Cleary Creek first. For instance, we had a doctor. His name was Dr. Danforth. And he rode a pinto horse from Chattanooga to Cleary, an 8-mile ride. And he rode it twice a week, unless somebody sent for him. He was a tall, spare man with a Van Dyke beard and a very forbidding countenance to a child such as I was. In fact, any time I saw the pinto horse coming up the creek, I'd run and hide in the closet. And I couldn't even remember this. He had an office in both towns. Chattanooga was a very small burg, while Cleary City was quite a city. He finally went to the Iditarod, where he later died. He couldn't have been as old as I remember him. A child looks upon somebody fairly young as being quite old. But he must have been a man well along in his 40s, as I remember him, because his beard was gray or white. Then we had another character, of whom you may have heard, Doc Stearns, who also drove a horse and wagon up and down the creek with the miscellaneous articles for sale, like needles and pins and dye and, notions. And one of the things that he had to sell one year was hair dye, both for men and women. And he tried out his own merchandise. Every time he came, his hair was a different color. One time I remember very well that it was a distinct purplish hue, much to my mother's disgust. She was very Puritan about things like this. Then there was another very loved character, Big Eric, or Red Eric. He was a very large man. Eric Nelson was his name. And he had reddish blonde hair and sometimes mustache, you know, the handlebar kind. He drove stage summer and winter from Chattanooga to Clary. We weren't too, as I recall, we weren't too interested in Fairbanks. That was too far away. And this is before the day of the railroad. Then in the winter time, of course, the stage was just glorious because it was a double-ender with heavy bear robes and wolf robes into which people would crowd to go to the dances at the A.B. Hall in Clary City. Now, the A.B. Hall was the biggest place up there outside the Nordale, the plush Nordale Hotel. It's a two-story building. And AB stands for Arctic Brotherhood. There were probably 10 different brotherhoods. There was one I know in Clary, one in Fairbanks. I know there was one in the Iditarod. I know there was one at Nome. There must have been others. To my knowledge, the Arctic Brotherhood must have folded about 1912. And it has been completely and utterly impossible for me to find a watch fob, which was a very ordinary possession of all the members of this organization in those days. They did wear a pin also. They were completely social. They had their dances. The AB Hall was also strung from the rafters with heavy ropes that the strong young men used to overhand, pull themselves across the hall several feet off the ground. I don't know what you call that. But they'd even have races doing this. Of course, they'd haul the ropes up into the rafters for the dances. There was no such problem as babysitting in those days. Children were loaded into the stages and taken along to the parties that were all-night parties also. And everybody would bring food. They'd have meals interminably. When the children got tired, they'd put them to sleep in the back of the room on tables with some robes over them, and daylight go on back down the creek to home. Christmas was spent, as I remember it, always at the AB Hall for all families, and there wasn't a child that didn't have simply mounds of packages. Because I suppose there weren't, well, between 2 below Clary and 12 below, I don't suppose there were 6 children of varying ages, and hundreds of lonely men. So, of course, Christmas was a day for children, but it was also a day for men to devote themselves to that. In 1910, in the winter of 1910, my family had made enough money so that they were going to do what everybody dreamed of doing in those days, was go outside with a poke and invest their money someplace and live a life of leisure. We went to Los Angeles and invested the poke in a grapefruit ranch, it was called then. Well, inside of a year, of course, nobody could stand to live in Los Angeles. And we returned to Clary with practically no money and never had any cents. As they used to say in those days, and ours was not an unusual case, it was the usual case. Everybody came trekking back and put what little money they had left back into the ground. This was a common phrase then. So we followed suit. We never did seem to get it back out. By that time, I was of school age, a little past school age. So in the winter times, Mother and I moved to town so that I could go to school here. She had taught me some, so I went into the second grade. I must have been 7 years old when I went into the second grade here.
Town of Fairbanks.
The town of Fairbanks. And the log house where we lived is still here on 9th and Lacey, and the birch trees, that my mother dug out of the swamp across the street are still growing there. They're a beautiful size now. They were just tiny saplings when she dug them out and planted them in the yard. One of them I notice, and you know I go by every time I'm up there, it looks as if it were broken down in a heavy wind now, and it's been sawed off about 3 feet from the ground. But the others look very healthy. School continued for me here in Fairbanks. We never went outside again until 1921. And my mother wasn't in very good health. We went south to California. And I had my last year in high school at Hollywood High School in Los Angeles. But all the other years of my schooling were here at what's now known as Maine School. The school days of Fairbanks, I imagine, have been treated pretty consistently by many of your speakers. I remember particularly the very cold days of winter when I was little, how heavily we dressed. I remember we wore long underwear with long sleeves and then long stockings, and felt shoes were the best thing for the very cold weather. I seldom see them anymore. They must have been at least half an inch thick, maybe more. And they were the warmest things that we could put on our feet, and they laced up rather high. There was an element of danger in wearing of the felt shoes, however, because they were too warm inside a house. And the children at school would maybe have, their feet would be too warm, and their feet would perspire so much that their stockings would be much too damp, and if they had far to walk home, there was a danger of frostbite if they didn't really make a run for it. I don't remember overshoes until maybe I was 10 years old or so, and they were the kind with the buckles and the clamps that, well, boys still wear. Our coats were, well, my coats were handmade. My mother made all of my clothes from necessity, as well as having the ability to sew beautifully. And often they were made out of hand-me-downs from men's coats, which were heavy. But I can remember one coat that was made out of a heavy blanket and lined with some rabbit fur. I have no idea where she got that, but I remember it had a fur lining through the top of the shoulders and came out around my neck in a small collar.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
I have no brothers nor sisters, nor did my father have any brothers. So that as far as the name Gostad is concerned, it is wiped out. The Norwegians, of course, as you know, take the name of their town. There is a town of Gostad just outside of the city of Oslo from where my father came. His father was the head farmer for the town of Gostad, which has been for many years, two centuries, the site of the National Mental Hospital. So this has been a source of great family joking at my expense. We were back in Oslo a few years ago, and the stone house that had been for many centuries the head farmer's house is still the head farmer's house. And we were able to discover that none of my grandfather's family are known. There was a I guess you could almost call it a scourge of tuberculosis at the time that my grandfather came to the United States. He had three sons, and two sons died very close together when my father was young from tuberculosis, and he lost two brothers at the same time. And this is what started him on his way to the United States. He thought he wanted to get away from it, whether this was it or not, I don't know. At least he escaped it. Now, where should I go from here?
Oh, your younger childhood days.
Teenager. From...
What kind of kids were they here?
Well, of course, there were very few of us. Fairbanks, from 1910 to 1925, was a very small town. I think it claimed 2,000 people, and I'd be surprised if it had more than 1,200. We knew each other very well, naturally, with that few people in town.
Did they have Sunday schools?
Yes.
Church?
We had, as a matter of fact, we had two hospitals in those days. The St. Joseph's Hospital may have been the first one that was put up when Father Monroe was here. And there was an Episcopal hospital, and it was down in the same area as the Episcopal Church was then and is today. It was a hospital, I guess, if memory serves me correctly, probably had 30 beds. It was not a very large hospital, as times would go today. And it was run by the Episcopal Church. That hospital probably lasted until 1918, somewhere in there before it closed its doors.
It's there during the flu epidemic.
18
was the flu epidemic.
Were you here during the fire?
Which fire?
Fairbanks.
Oh, you mean where the block went down? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We had two really disastrous fires. One on the other side of the NC Company, and then one in the block where the Model Hotel, Model Cafe is now. And I remember very well the one where the great big saloon burnt down on the corner of First and Cushman. I don't know what year that was, but it went on for 2 or 3 days, maybe this is stretching it a bit, and all the bottles were broken and all the liquor was running. This was before Prohibition, naturally, or we wouldn't have had a saloon. It was a great thing. It was in winter time. Everybody went down to listen to it sizzle.
Who owned that saloon,
then? I don't know. I have no idea. I can remember a famous bartender here, who must have been a bartender in many different bars, but he was in that bar at one time. His name was Bill McPhee. He was a tall, big man, and a well-known character, and a good man. Well, there was another character here about that time. H.D. Brown.
Uh-huh.
Harry D. Brown. Of course, you've covered him, haven't you?
No, go ahead.
And this is when he really made himself very useful. This was in the early days when Fairbanks was booming, and he continued to make himself useful up until the time he left. At first, he carried two guns in order to enforce his trade. What would you call him? A glorified bill collector? When people, when it was suspected that somebody was leaving town between 2 days, as they used to say, with the outstanding bills of some importance, they would ask H.D. to check into it. And I'm sure he never fired a gun in his life. He may not have had ammunition for them, as far as I know, because he was a big, blustery type. But I'm sure that he wouldn't have harmed hair of anybody's head, but he knew he collected a lot of outstanding debts. The fun for me, of course, was to go back to the mine in the summertime as soon as school was out, while we moved back on the mine. And this was life for me. Even up until the time I was a teenager, apparently I was never lonely out there. There were no children around to play with, but probably because I had had the first years of my life living alone on the mine, I continued to enjoy it in the summertime. We had, we had many things to do. It was customary. This was drift mining on Clear East, perhaps you know. And so the crews were large. I'm sure I recall that there were about 40 men in a crew, and every mine had what they called a bunkhouse and a mess house. You got the best workers, of course, with the best conditions. The better your bunkhouse and the better your mess house, especially mess house, the better workers you got. And of course, it was a 12-hour day, and you worked around the clock in the drift. We used to, in the spring, you see, I was too young to remember, but we would acquire a litter of small pigs in the little piglets, very cute little things in the spring, ship them out to the mine, and they lived off the scraps from the mess house all summer and grew to a quite enormous size by fall and kept on until freeze-up when they were butchered and frozen and kept frozen in old shafts. They were hung down there because they would stay frozen then through the spring thaws until we were ready to open up again in the spring. And this was our pork, fresh pork for the following year. This was done several times that I remember. And why they stopped doing it, I don't know. The thing that puzzles me is that probably along about 1915, there were several cases of trichinosis in this town, and I remember a very desperate case of mother and daughter nearly dying of it. This may have been, whether this had anything to do with the use of the pork that you grew yourself. I guess you don't grow it yourself, do you, but you raise it yourself in my, or not, I don't know whether it had anything to do with it. Was many people would perhaps remember the name of, the youngster's name was Helen Durand, and her mother, Mrs. Durand. And as I recall, they were then on Little El Dorado, which is the creek just this side of Chattanooga. We also raised chickens for the same purpose, but we used them for fryers during the summer. I also remember that from the 4th of July on, the miners who tried to set the best table, although that isn't what they called it then, would buy beer from, I think it was the Fairbanks Brewery. The beer was delivered, by this time the railroad was in operation, of course, so that things could be shipped in. The beer was packed in bottles in big barrels. And these barrels were just delivered in front of the mess house. And as the men would come out for lunch or dinner, they would, each one that wanted one, would take his bottle of beer. This lasted through, it must have lasted, as I recall it, through at least the month of July. In some way or other, it sticks in my mind that has something to do with the 4th of July. In those years, we had a three-day celebration. I'm sure many of your speakers have dealt with it. It was the 21st of June. This was the Festival of the Midnight Sun. And it was as big, if not a bigger, celebration than the 4th of July in Fairbanks. The city was decorated beautifully. All of the streets were decorated. In those days, there was a society called the Native Sons and Daughters of the Golden North. And they always had a beautiful handmade float decorated with gold hearts and white streamers, and little girls wore white dresses and long white stockings, and many of them even had white shoes, which had started out in life as black and got painted white. The little boys were all dressed up too. The pin for the Native Sons and Daughters of the Golden North was the head of a malamute with two bright green eyes. I have one yet, that's how I remember so well. This society came upon bad times because they passed a regulation that the Native Sons and Daughters of the Golden North had to be born in Alaska. And there were quite a few of us that were not born in Alaska. We were born in Dawson, so we were asked to leave, and so many of us were in the same fix that there was nothing much left of this organization. So it kind of dropped out of the picture for many years. They tried to bring it back along in the 20s sometime, but I have not heard anything of it since. These celebrations were hardly over, as you can see, when the 4th of July celebration came into being. And it was the same kind of a celebration. People came in from the creeks in hundreds and filled all the hotels in town. By that time, the Nordale Hotel had built even a larger hotel in Fairbanks than it had on Cleary City, on Front Street. It was the Fairbanks Hotel, it was the Pioneer Hotel, and the Lacey Street Hotel. So you see, it had a lot of rooms for the men from the creeks, who came in with plenty of money to spend. I forgot something about the Midnight Sun deal, of course. Yes, those were the years when they started the ball game at midnight on the 21st of June. And it was played consistently through the years. Maybe they still play ball on the 21st of June at midnight. And, of course, there were all kinds of foot races, as there still are, 4th of July. But I remember one of the greatest racers here was George Herring, a member of this family. In fact, he was a brother of Tom and Art Herring, who lived here yet, Donald Herring, Muriel Johnson. He probably was the outstanding racer here. He was a small man and slim, didn't have an extra ounce on him. Maybe this contributed to his success.
Maybe those children that was stewarded in, are they still around?
Oh, yes. One of, Muriel Herring, Mrs. Carl Johnson. We lived in the same neighborhood, so we were close friends, and still are. Stella Harrington, she was then, is now Mrs. Boyd Herring. As a matter of fact, Stella and I were friends, played together in Chattanooga when we were quite small. Stella was also born in Dawson and came to Chattanooga to live.
She's the one that has the store now?
She's the one that has the store, Mrs. Boyd Herring. And Boyd Herring came to town about the time we were all in high school, maybe a little sooner. There were, my goodness, I'm sure there are many others here still. Mary Berglund, who was Mary Miller. Mrs. Mary Miller is one of our old pioneers here, and she is the mother of Cliff Berglund, went to school with us. Charlie Guise, who is a brother of Dorothy Reedy, Mrs. Ray Reedy, went to school with us.
teachers' names?
Well, teachers' names, of course, there was Mrs. Harris, who was the principal for a while. She was our strictest principal. She came to town and with a clean new broom to sweep with, and many of our mothers who felt that the town needed cleaning up, have you ever heard this before through the years? We're right behind her. They had a citizens committee, I think was the name of it, to try to do away with sin and depravity and make the city a better place to live. Miss Carpenter and Miss Myrick were two fine teachers who came up here as among our first tourists, liked it so well, they stayed. They got themselves a job. Miss Carpenter was a sixth grade teacher for many years here, and Miss Myrick was the Latin teacher in the high school and became the principal of the high school, was the principal of the high school when Bob and I went to high school here. Well, Bob Bartlett, of course, was here all the same time, too. Oh, yes. Bob was one of these unlucky ones. In those real early days up in Dawson, if your parents had any money at all, they'd go to Seattle to have the baby. So Bob's parents had a little money, and he was born in Seattle. I was born in Dawson. But he arrived on Golden, I think it was, when he was less than a year old and grew up here. He had a sister, Doris, who became ill when she was about 12 years old. Doris was 4 years older than Bob and was sick for 4 years before she died in Long Beach, California. Some of the great fun we had as teenagers sounds pretty pallid now, but in the spring of the year, all of us, probably all 30 of us that were in high school, would hike out to Birch Hill, just around the base of Birch Hill, from the curve which is still there that turns to the left, we would turn to the right, and walk probably another half mile and up the hill to pick gunny sacks full of crocuses. And
we still do.
We know where that spot is. We can't get them there, but we did when we first came.
Of course, they were really lovely. And I remember bringing them home and our mothers putting them in vases and bowls all over the house, and that they looked beautiful. And I can't see how they could withstand that long walk packed into a gunny sack or whatever sack we had, but they certainly have to be a tough flower to come up through that snow. Then we used to, in the wintertime, go even further to Lizelle's farm in, again, the double ender with the heavy robes, and they used to heat great big rocks and put in the hay. We call them hay rides then. We'd spend the whole night dancing and singing, and Mrs. Lizelle would put out simply quantities of food for us. This was, we would do this maybe a couple of times in the winter. This was just about the height of our gaiety. There were many shows then, too, home talent shows in Fairbanks. There used to be a man here, Johnny Kelly, who was a talented performer and director. And he used to put on what he called the tombolas. They were a variety show was just the proper thing for a town this age, because you could draw talent from every age group and from all kinds of groups of people, church groups and other groups as well, school groups. This he did. I remember one time a little girl had a particularly lovely little song to sing, and she was dressed like an angel. And maybe it was an Easter or Christmas party, I don't know, tombola. And she appeared at the footlights, and her lips moved, and the music rolled on and finally finished, but not one note had come out of her lips. And of course, the audience just went crazy with applause. And I'm sure to this day that child doesn't know that there was really quite touching. I'll never forget that. Later on, there was a young teacher came, Grace Clark, came from North Dakota, who was a talented dancer, had been a ballet dancer. And she put on many shows here, which were very good. This keeps reminding me of different people who put on shows. This is quite disjointed, isn't it? You'll have to do something about this. Sam Godfrey was also quite talented in the little theater, if you want to call it that. He put on a lot of, all those, what do they call these shows? You know, the blackface shows? Minstrel shows. This was his fort. And he did many of these, as well as teaching some dancing.
He can dance?
Yes. He had taken a course of ballroom dancing in New York City from a famous dancing couple on the turn of the century.
The Stairs.
No, you see, that he was too late. In the First World War, does it recall to you a name? Well, it'll come and you can write it. Oh, no. No, it's too long ago. Oh, yes. Thank you.
The flu epidemic, Mrs. Bartlett.
The flu was probably as great a disaster for Fairbanks as the First World War. The First World War, one way or another, took the youth of our area. Those who got into the war didn't return, and many of the young men who left here left on the last summertime stage to pick up the Canadian liner Sophia out of Skagway, out of Whitehorse, and it was wrecked outside of Juneau, and all lives were lost, so that those young men were lost before they ever had a chance to enlist. The other disaster, of course, was the flu. I'm sure that records would show how many died of it. There were a great many people who died, many who were debilitated for several years from the very intense course of a really dread disease at that time. The women who were untouched by the flu, as long as they were untouched by the flu, worked in any locality that they were needed. First of all, when the flu first struck, of course, the hospital filled up. Then the hotels filled up. And the call went out for all able-bodied women to come to help nurse these people with facilities that were completely inadequate, of course. I remember my mother went to the Fairbanks Hotel and had several rooms that she was more or less in charge of. The doctors and the nurses with any training at all, I think, probably never went to bed. They were just on duty all the time over a period of at least 2 weeks. Women who were unable to leave the family home, either because of sickness at home, flu at home, or some other reason, would take care not only of their own family, but anybody in the neighborhood that was near enough so that they could go back and forth and look after them. Then soon the women weren't enough, so they called on the young schoolgirls. The school was closed. I remember Muriel Herring and I, Mrs. Carl Johnson to you, went to the hospital, where we washed dishes interminably and performed all kinds of errands. I was just speaking of the one terrible job that was thrown my way one day that I couldn't get out of doing, was measuring aspirin, and aspirin must have been very new then. It was a powder which was weighed out on a little scales, much like a gold scales, and four. And this powder then, in turn, was shaken into water by the patients. This was a very tedious job, and of course, not liked very well by me, but on the other hand, it took such a long time to do this sort of work that it was better to use child labor than somebody who would have more ability and capability in the caring of the sick. Then finally my mother went down with the flu, and she was dreadfully ill. So I stayed home to take care of her. My father was in the Live and Good Country at the time. And so it fell to me to take care of the people in my immediate neighborhood. Across the street, in a house that still stands, were the Senna family, Mr. and Mrs. Their son was one who had gone down on the Sophia. And not only were they suffering from broken hearts, they had a very serious case of the flu. I had not only to provide care for the sick, but I had to do cooking, and for a 14-year-old, this wasn't very much of a job. But Mother, from her sickbed, of course, could tell me what to do. Among other things, I prepared an enormous pot full of soup, barley soup. I think barley soup's still supposed to be good for the ailing, which I made from mutton, and doled this out to all the sick people in the neighborhood. As Mr. Seneff, who was very sick, gradually recovered, he complimented me on this wonderful broth that he thought had done him so much good, and he wanted to know what kind it was. And when I told him it was mutton broth, he was nearly sick all over again, because he was one of these people who would not allow mutton in his house for some untold reason, as far as I'm concerned. There was another man whose house was kitty-corner to ours. And that house still stands, too. And his name was Sam Papadopoulos. He was a Greek, naturally, who had a little business downtown. It seems to me it was maybe an ice cream parlor and a pool hall and that sort of thing. Anyway, somehow connected with his business, he had fresh fruit every week. Now, Sam was a terribly sick man. He was out of his head for a couple of days, which was frightening to me, but the doctor insisted that I had to stay there. There was nobody else to stay with him. And so I did all I was supposed to do. And when Sam got well, he was inordinately grateful for the little bit that I could do for him. And for as long as he lived there and we lived there, he brought Mother and me enormous baskets of fruit every time he got fresh fruit. Now, fresh fruit in those days, before 1920, would be like getting a basket of nuggets today. I can remember the big oranges and apples and bananas, which were the finest thing I thought I'd ever eaten that he used to bring us. That was also the same neighborhood that the Bunnells lived in. And I remember that Mrs. Bunnell had probably one of the most severe cases of flu in our immediate neighborhood at that time. Everybody was really terribly frightened that she might not make it. But of course, she did. Jean was a little girl then, probably, maybe she was 9 or 10 years old that time. Then there was another man who lived alone. You must remember this was a country of men. In a neighborhood of a dozen houses, probably a third of them would be lived in by men alone. And these were the people that would go down with the flu. There was nobody to know they were sick until maybe you noticed that there was no sign of footsteps to and from their door. This was just after most of the snow had gone, and it was slushy and muddy, so that this was the only way you really checked up on people to know whether they were down with the flu or up with the flu or able to do anything. I think that I remember as summer came on that there were many side effects from the flu. I've often wondered what those side effects could have been, but I remember many people had very serious complications all through that summer. I know that there was one young girl, a very beautiful young girl, probably of about 20, whose last name was Jacobson, who died. And I believe it was thought that she died of tuberculosis, maybe brought on by this. Now, whether this is true or not, I don't know, but this was the talk at the time. Then there was another girl, and there was the Peterson family, Pearl Peterson and her sister, and her sister's name escapes me, but she had what probably turned out to be rheumatic fever. The doctor at the time didn't know what it was, but she was very sick for many, many months, and it affected her heart. This is why I'm sure now that it is rheumatic fever. They lived in the house that was next door to the Presbyterian manse at that time. I think as far as, the doctor's names you must remember were Dr. Sutherland. And a cute thing about Dr. Sutherland, in those days there were two Mrs. Sutherlands in this town. And in order to separate them, there was Mrs. Sutherland and Mrs. Dr. Sutherland. Then there was Dr. Hall, who took care of our particular neighborhood during the flu, as I recall. There was Dr. Delaverne, of course, who lived on, and many people remember here. There was a Dr. McCollum, who was an unmarried doctor who lived here in those years. And I'm afraid that this is all that I can remember of the doctors that time. I think that this was the time, it may have been a little later, that Sister Romanoff came to, and I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but you can check it, to the hospital here. She was a young woman. I'm sure now that she couldn't have been more than 20 at the very most. And as you know, she just retired from here as Sister Superior during the summer. She wasn't here all the time. She was here in those early days and came back. But I remember her so well as a young sister coming here at that particular period. Then we wanted to go on to, teenage living, did you say? In Fairbanks. Of course, a lot of my teenage living was still out on the creeks, but we, in those days, Fairbanks was so small that Saturday night here, almost every Saturday night, there was a big public dance at the Eagles Hall or the Moose Hall or the Masonic Hall. I think that takes care of the halls. And everybody came, that is, young mothers and fathers and daughters and young boys. And I don't think there was any such thing as dating until probably the end of high school. People just all came together to the dances. And dances were a really gay affair. they lasted and lasted and lasted. In the summertime, the dances would often not quit until 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. This appalls me at my age.
And you dance every dance,
too. Oh,
well,
yes.
It didn't
oh,
then.
Yes. No, it didn't then, because this was the thing I loved best in life. I went to Live and Good for a couple of summers along about 19 and 20. The town of Live and Good was then Brooks. The post office was Brooks.
Oh, I had somebody asking me where Brooks was the other day.
Well, it's where Live and Good is today.
It
it's the same thing. Yes, uh-huh, the street. The main street of Live and Good today was the main street of Brooks then.
You went over Wickersham Dome?
Yes. Hmm. As a matter of fact, I went over on horseback once, and then once went by the Carl White up the Tanana to the Live and to the Tolavana and up the Tolavana to the log jam. This was as far as the Carl White could go. And it was far enough. You know about it. I'm sure you've had lots of stories about it. Well, it was a very small stern wheeler.
Very small.
Very small.
Carl White?
Carl White. And that was his name, and he called his boat the same. And at the log jam was a cabin, which was a very poor structure. There was almost always, you hopefully, a cook there so you could get a bite to eat before you started up the tram to Brooks. Now, the tram was 14 miles long, maybe 16.
That would be the road they used later from Dunbar to Live and Good. Well, you're joining it way up the river.
Yeah, could be. The tram was, there was a sawmill 7 miles from Brooks, down on the west fork of the Tolavana River. And my father bought that from I think it was Mr. Cascaden.
Oh.
The tram was laid from the log jam to the sawmill to Brooks. The rails were 3 2x4s stacked, so that this would be 6 inches by 4. And the power was a Dodge car from which the wheels had been taken, and flanged wheels put on. Little freight cars, open-face freight cars, were made also with flanged wheels, which the Dodge car pulled on behind. This was almost all swamp country from the log jam up to Brooks. And so every time, as we used to say, any time anybody or a porcupine or a moose fell over a niggerhead, why, the tramway would either sink or raise or something, and off would go the Dodge car into the niggerheads with all the freight after it. Terrible days those were. But you know, there was a strange thing too about the country. I remember the just quantities of porcupines, and they simply adored to get on the rails, and you couldn't get them off. You could bump them along a little bit, and they wouldn't get off. And you'd have to, if you didn't want to run over them, and running over them, even if you wanted to run over them, was a serious business, because that might be just enough of a bump to put everything off the track. So you'd have to stop the car and get out and get a stick and push him off and dash back into the car and get it going before you got back on again.
It was easier walking for him,
wasn't it? Oh, my, yes. It was, oh yes, just like the moose and Palmer now. They get into the plowed roadways and just try and get them to move out. You just go follow along behind.
That's the interesting part.
Well,
of the
tram. Well, you suppose that went as far as where the bridge is going all over to Manly Hot Springs? That's the Tolavana there, too.
Well, it's different route, Mom. I'll tell you all. Well, they'll go there and find evidence of it.
Yeah.
Well, there are parts of the tram to be found yet. Somebody was telling me the other day, they said that you go down and you can find some. Oh, I'll tell you a story about the mill there, the sawmill, too,
good,
on the west fork of the Tolavana. It was it had been there for some years before we took over. It was the only source of lumber supply for that area. Of course, there were great big dumps of sawdust that were as big as the dumps from underground mining. Only it was sawdust. And about a mile from this place on the West Fork lived a man who was a bootlegger, and his name was Perkins, Cy Perkins. Now, Cy Perkins was not his real name, and nobody knew his real name, because when he left the upper country, as we used to call it, he was in some kind of trouble. And so he took the name of Cy Perkins, which was the name of a whiskey that known to some people of that era. So Cy Perkins, I don't remember how he ever got this cabin there. He had a nice cabin and a simply beautiful garden, not only vegetables, but beautiful flowers. And he raised chickens, and he also had some fighting cocks. Now, alive and good in the early days, Brooks, the Toll of Anna, was a wide open place. There was a lot of sinful living over there. The gambling was high, wide, and handsome. And of course, the fighting cocks were a source of income to the bootlegger, Cy Perkins. Well, rumor came to my father that the revenue agents were on their way over. And so he thought he better warn Cy, he better get his stuff away. So Cy said, well, he didn't know he'd heard about him coming before. It was pretty well hidden. But he says, if they come on the train, you shoot your gun twice, and that'll give me just enough time. Well, it sounded right. Bob, my father always had to have a gun on the train. So we were coming up from the log jam one day, and got off at the sawmill, and my mother had just made blueberry pies and put them on the back porch to cool. And here were some dogs coming up to nibble. So my dad took a shot at them, not to hit them, but to frighten them away. He took two shots. You know what happened. They said that all of the stuff that he poured into this little stream there, some of it washed back and all the chickens got drunk.
Did your father run that tram?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, this was part of the sawmill. Oh. If you owned the sawmill, you owned the tram.
Did he build the tram too?
No, the tram was built when he got it.
Well, with that sawmill, let's see, the Toll of Anna, which side of Brooks? Before you get to Brooks or on the other side?
Well, this was coming up from the Toll of Anna River. It's a different approach from the one overland out of Olness and Wickersham Dome. I mean, you come at it this way.
And how old were you then when you lived there at the sawmill?
Oh, about 13, 14.
Before the flu epidemic?
No.
You said you're 14 when that flu epidemic.
Yes. I was older, I guess. Yes. Must have been 15 or 16 when I was over there. It was after the flu epidemic. There was a girl that went to school here in town with us, Cleora Cassidy, her name was, with an IDY.
IDY.
And she married and lived there, and her name was Cleora Bachner. There is, of course, a young Bachner here in town. And every time I see him, I feel terribly old, because I remember when he was born. And he has children. Well, then to come back to Fairbanks, of course, for school, there were 13 in our graduating class in high school.
What year?
1922.
Lou Joy, give you your diploma?
Probably. It'd be the first one, first Lou Joy. Probably. Although I did not graduate with my class here, because I had my last year outside, so I missed being here for that. But Bob was graduated here. And from here, he went out to the University of Washington for 1 year. And then came back for a while. Went to work on a news minor and went to university and college, it was called then, out here.
You did attend school together then in Furman?
Yes.
Bob and you?
Yes. We, well, I don't, I hardly remember a time when I don't remember Bob. The first, oh yes, I do. The first time I remember him was about 1911 or 12. We had both come back to Fairbanks, and we were living in temporary houses down on Wendell. And this was the thing to do that year, I guess we were about 7, 8 years old, was to have a pen store. So everybody had pen stores. Anything that you could beg, borrow, or steal from your parents to sell, you put in your little store, and you sold them for pens. And of course, there must have been some real great tragedies. I'm sure that many parents lost many things they didn't intend to lose for pens. And I remember Bob was just back from the outside from Southern California. And of course, he had the best pen store of all. This was my first memory of him.
Is it P-I-N or
P-E-N? P-I-N, pens. And pens didn't come in papers then. They came in things in a roll.
Oh, yeah.
That they were stuck into. Then, as years went by, Bob lived in the neighborhood where, well, he lived most of his life. It was on 3rd, near the cemetery. I don't remember what the cross street was. And neighborhoods were pretty inclusive. So our paths didn't cross much outside of the schoolroom. And his neighborhood was, let me see, there were, oh, half a dozen boys, Clifford Smith and Clarence Berglund and Tommy Tonseth and Charlie Guys, Tommy Tonseth. Yes, he's the Naval Academy boy. And I think the Calderheads lived down there. I don't just recall. And then the Roth girls lived there. Mrs. Art Loftus and Mrs. Thompson now. And
Mrs. Thompson, was she there?
No, Mrs. Thompson, Mrs. Charles Thompson. The two Roth girls were Dorothy and Florence, and Dorothy is Mrs. Art Loftus, and Florence is Mrs. Charles Thompson. And he's been with the State Department ever since they were married in 1930. They're now in Costa Rica. And then there was another girl lived in that neighborhood, Ruth Logan. So that was one little neighborhood. It's contrasted with our neighborhood where there was Muriel Herring and the Smith twins, two young girls, and the Perinan sisters, and the Sumi girls. And, for a long time, Stella Harrington lived up there, who is now Mrs. Boyd Herring. Well, she lived in the Tonset. She's the Tonset. And they lived in, oh, I think they lived next door to Bob, if I recall correctly. Very close, anyway.
She lives back there now, near the cemetery.
Oh, she must live in the same house, the Tonset house. Yes, she must. It was a log house in those days. I noticed many log houses are covered. Some of the, I can remember the first cars that came to town. The first one of our generation who had a car was Clarence Berglund's father. And it was a disaster for us, for my family, because Clarence took me for a ride in the car. We came clear from Fairbanks across the river and started out toward Fox. And we got as far as, almost as far as the Bentley Dairy. And he decided it was a good idea for me to learn how to drive. So I got in the car and drove it right smack in the ditch. Well, of course, you realize this wasn't very far. It was in walking distance. This was a long ways then, but we walked back to town. So my father had to have that brand new automobile fixed up. And it was not cheap, and he was pretty disgusted. But anyway, he took it in his stride, and he was the mechanic anyway. When automobiles first came out, he went to automobile school before he bought himself an automobile and learned to drive. This was this year that we went outside to live in affluence ever after. And so he did learn how to, he learned how to put an automobile together. It wasn't anything about an automobile he didn't know. So he came back, and by that time there were a few old cars around, and he picked up enough parts around to put together what he called a bug. The top was hardly a top, but it had a motor and four wheels. And he taught me to drive. And so I had my own bug, which I drove around here for a couple of years. Well, that must have been about 1920. And it was 1920. Bob had a car then, or his father had a car. And as you know, his father had always been in the freight business. He started out, he had the biggest mule team that ever came into the Dawson country, and had freighted all of his life. This was his main source of income. And so, of course, he went from horses to automobiles and trucks and so forth and so on. But he never really mastered the driving of a Ford, so he was nearly always in trouble with his driving his car. So Bob learned to drive almost right away in self-preservation and to preserve the life of his father. So there were several cars around. It wasn't very long till my father came to town and from Live and Good, and in an effort to recoup some finances, started what I suppose was the first, NC Company had the first automobile agency, the Ford here. And my dad had the Oakland. There was a carrier here called E.H. Mack, an insurance man. And he had a car that had a gear shift. Now, I don't know what kind of a car that must have been, but he drove it for a year or so, and my father tried to get him to sell that and buy one from him. In an effort to get him to buy the car, he took E.H. Mack for drive and showed him how to drive it, taught him how to drive. And E.H. Mack was enchanted with it. It was a robin's egg blue roadster, they called it. And he was further enchanted with it because it had three gears, low, second, and high. And my father said, well, so does your Chevrolet. He said, why, no, it only has two gears. So he had never got out of second gear all the year he drove the Chevrolet.
Well, Mrs. Bartlett, this intrigues me, your talk with automobiles and the first ones in Fairbanks. I would like to ask you, can you remember a steamer that was in town and who might have owned it? Stanley Steamer?
I don't remember Stanley Steamer, but I do remember the first Franklin that was here. My father brought it in and sold it to the banker, Mr. Hutchinson.
because when I first came here in 1937, there was an old Stanley steamer, the remains of one, over in Grail on the side of the Chena Slough, the boiler and engine and so forth.
Maybe Bob would remember that. Men would be more apt to remember.
Well, this has been a very delightful afternoon with you, Mrs. Bartlett. And because you have just 5 minutes to get to your dinner date, we will have to sign it off, reminding you that Bob must give us the tape this winter in Washington.
Thank you.